My name is Eric Jorsted, and this is the first session in our series called Faith and Law. To start with, let me say that I wasn't expecting that tonight was going to be on sanctuary. When I first set up this series, I thought, well, let's start with all the nice, broad, theoretical questions about what is law, why should we obey the law, and so on. And then later in the week, we'd move to the case study, once we had the theory down. Because of the scheduling of the forum this evening on sanctuary, I flip-flopped it, so that the first two sessions, today and tomorrow morning, are on the case studies, and later in the week, we'll be developing the theory. What I realized after the fact is that probably is a good legal approach to things, because if this was a law school course, we'd start with the cases, and we'd spin the theory out of the cases anyway. So I will try to stretch my theologically trained sensibilities into a lawyer's mold, at least in our methodology for this week. Let me start by saying a few words about myself, and then we'll dig into the topic. I've been working on sanctuary ever since it rather surprisingly entered my life in December of 1982. I was then on the staff of Central Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. I don't know if we have any other Minnesotans in the bunch. Yeah, there's a couple. Yeah, sure, you betcha. But St. Luke's Presbyterian Church in Wayzata had just declared public sanctuary. They had Rene Hurtado, a Salvadoran refugee in the flesh who was being harbored by their congregation. And they sent out letters to all the churches in the community saying, will you support us? Endorse our work. Well, Central, as careful and meticulous as they tend to be, said, well, we better study this. And yours truly ended up being in charge of that study. Well, push came to shove, and because Central is kind of a big congregation, 4,000 plus, we invited the State Department from Washington, and they said they'd come out. We invited the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and they said they'd come out. And we had Rene Hurtado himself come and speak, and I said a few things about theology, and we had a discussion. I wrote up what the whole thing was, and the ALC Office of Church and Society decided that looks like a good model for congregations considering sanctuary. So they published it. If your congregation and your ALC has been considering sanctuary, you probably read that article. Well, all that turned into my thesis for a Master of Theology at Luther Seminary at the time. I wrote the longest thesis in the history of Luther Seminary, 320 pages. So you're going to be in for a long haul here this evening. And several of the chapters of that thesis were published as articles in Christian Century and elsewhere, and I kind of became associated with thinking about the sanctuary movement. My political claim to fame on sanctuary is that the National Review, which is published by William F. Buckley Jr., last year chose to do a cover article critical of sanctuary, and they chose yours truly as the person to quote extensively and try to tear apart. Well, I thought I came off looking better than the author, but that's my own bias, and they have thrown us into the thick of it. But recently, I've reconsidered the whole thing. I worked at it in 1982 and 83, and in the last 3-4 months, I've come back to it again, here 3-4 years later. And I've come to some very different kinds of conclusions about what's going on in sanctuary. To begin with, how many of you are roughly familiar with the sanctuary movement when I mention it? About half the people. If you're familiar with it, you'll see how I've gravitated from the Chicago to the Tucson school. And I even wore my Arizona t-shirt tonight to show my bias from the start. What you're going to get is a presentation of the way the Tucson faith community understands the practice of sanctuary. So that's all rather cryptic to those of you who don't even know what sanctuary is yet, but I hope you'll come to understand it over the course of the evening. In 1980, three key events happened, all roughly at the same time. First of all, we had a new president elected who came in committed to new policies. Secondly, we had an act of Congress called the Refugee Act of 1980. And thirdly, we had a massive influx of Salvadorans across our southern border. It was these three events together which combined to create the sanctuary movement. When I sat and talked with John Fife, pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, he recounted how his first encounter with Salvadoran refugees in Tucson was in the summer of 1980, when 25 Salvadorans were dumped by their paid smuggler in the desert outside of Tucson. And if you know anything about El Salvador, it's a lush, wet, fertile country. These folks didn't know anything about the desert. And within one day, half of them had died of dehydration. At that point, someone came across them, brought them in for hospitalization, those who were surviving. And the church community was called in, as they often were, to help with assistance for undocumented and displaced persons. Well, that initial encounter was followed by hundreds and then thousands of Salvadorans pouring across the border into southern Arizona in 1980 and the early part of 1981. The people responsible for enforcing the border are the Border Patrol and the Immigration and Naturalization Service of the U.S. government, which I'll call the INS for short, the Immigration and Naturalization Services. They're under the Justice Department and the Attorney General. Well, the INS at first had never seen this many Salvadorans coming across the border and thought, well, we'll cooperate with whoever's going to help them. And so they worked together closely with the churches. The INS would catch these people just like they caught Mexicans who were crossing the border all the time previously. The churches would say, we'll take care of these people, so the INS would let them out into the church's custody, and then there'd be a hearing later on whether the Salvadorans would be granted admission into the country or whether they'd be deported back to their home country. That worked fine for several months through 1981, but then the first event that I mentioned started to take effect. Namely, President Reagan started to hand down some new policies, which said that the INS would no longer work cooperatively with the churches in releasing Salvadorans. They would now put a $5,000 bond on almost every one of them and hold them in a detention center until they could have a hearing regarding their deportation. They no longer trusted the churches to work together with them, but develop this adversary posture of saying, we want you to pay $5,000 on each one. Well, the churches at first said, these people are suffering enough, we're going to do what we can to care for them. They raised, for example, in one run to the El Centro Detention Center in California, they raised $135,000, and they bonded out, you know, you could do the mathematics, I'm not sure how many that is, but a large number of Salvadorans. But for everyone that they bonded out, for all the thousands of dollars and hundreds of thousands of dollars that they started to raise, there were more and more Salvadorans who were being put in detention. Now, why is it significant that the Salvadorans were in detention and feared of being deported? What was going on in El Salvador that led them to flee in the first place? And why didn't they want to go back to their home country? I mean, in Mexico, people are poor. They cross the border because they want work. If they get caught, they get sent back across the border. 3 days later, they're going to try again. That's essentially the way it works. What's different about the Salvadorans from the Mexican migrant workers who are crossing the border, which would be a whole other topic if we wanted to get into immigration law regarding Mexicans? Well, in El Salvador, there was a coup in October of 1979. And by early in 1980, the coup was starting to lead to increased activity by death squads. And first, a few political leaders, union leaders, priests, and so on were being assassinated by these death squads. Soon it was hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of Salvadorans who were being hunted down in the middle of the night by these death squads and assassinated or being captured, their bodies being dumped on the streets of the capital city of El Salvador the next morning, or being found without a head or with badly dismembered and disfigured in the ditch outside their village the next day. The people being targeted were chiefly those who were the democratic or centralist or opposition forces to the right-wing coup. People who were working in unions, teachers, health workers, priests, lots of church workers, as well as politicians and so on. But the death squads kind of went crazy, and our own State Department acknowledges that during an initial period there in 1980 and early 81, everything just got out of hand. And massacres of hundreds of people in one fell swoop, women and children as well as men, horrible torture and so on was all taking place. So the people were leaving El Salvador in massive numbers. They were being driven into the hills by the death squads, which were military officers in plain clothes operating at night. Why didn't they want to go back? Well, the State Department was providing the government with a list of people who were being deported back into El Salvador, and they didn't want to be sent back to precisely what they were fleeing in the first place. The incredible murder and torture and widespread violence that was soon catching up people whether they had been active in public life or not before. By around 1983 or so, to give some perspective, about 50,000 people had been murdered or disappeared in El Salvador. And about a million out of the country's 5 million inhabitants, roughly 20% of the whole population of the nation, was displaced, was no longer at home. About half of those were internally in refugee camps or hiding in the mountains. The other half had fled to Guatemala, to Mexico, and many of them finally into the United States. So this is what was happening. All of a sudden, the churches along the border were being swamped with these refugees who were threatened with being sent back. Originally, they worked closely with the government, but once the government closed the door and said, "We won't work with you anymore," then they had to make a decision. What can we do? Well, they followed the traditional routes. They lobbied their representatives and their senators. They wrote letters to the Attorney General. They had pickets in front of the federal building. They had a weekly prayer vigil on behalf of the people of El Salvador. All the normal courses of trying to influence public policy, but things just seemed to get worse. Finally, somewhere late in 1981, Jim Corbett and John Fife in Tucson got together and said, "This is crazy. This all the system is doing is sending people back to be murdered and holding them in these terrible detention centers. We've got to do something. We're going to have to evade the authorities in order to protect these people's lives." And they started the Ministry of Hospitality, is what they first called it. Hospitality in terms of providing transportation, shelter, food, and clothing for these many Salvadoran refugees who are pouring through their area. John Fife recounts it as one of the most difficult times in his life because they were confronted with these horror stories on their doorstep day after day, and they were being overwhelmed with the need, and they were just trying to survive from day to day to keep things moving. This was long before there was publicity nationwide, long before Ed Bradley did his 60 Minutes report and so on, when they were being swamped. Well, early in 82, the INS sent a not-so-covert message to Corbett and Fife saying, "We know what you're up to, and if you don't stop it, we're going to arrest you." Well, they believed that they couldn't stop doing what they were doing. So they had to decide, well, do we just wait until we're indicted and face trial as smugglers? Or do we take the initiative and try to define in the public's mind what we're really on about? And it was somewhere in that time when they hit up with the idea of sanctuary. It wasn't like they had this concept of sanctuary and then they said, oh, let's go do it with Salvadoran refugees. It emerged out of the practice, and they had originally called it a ministry of hospitality. Sanctuary kind of came on later. And their idea was that they were going to set the terms of discussion. Instead of it being defined as a trial for smugglers. You're going to hear about screaming babies in my sermon tomorrow night, so remember that. I have one of my own. Instead of it being a trial of smugglers, this was going to be an appeal to the moral conscience of the religious community, saying we are providing sanctuary in the ancient tradition of churches harboring vulnerable and threatened people. And on March 1982, Southside Presbyterian, together with four other congregations, made a public declaration of sanctuary, saying we're not hiding anything. We are sheltering these Salvadoran refugees who are being threatened by the U.S. government. We tell the world, they sent a letter to the U.S. Attorney General describing precisely what they were doing, and said our faith demands that we follow the higher law of God and care for these threatened people. They quoted a number of Old Testament and New Testament passages regarding protecting people in need. After their actions, by the middle of 1984 and 85, there were over 300 sanctuary congregations who had publicly declared sanctuary across the country. Tiny little fellowships, gigantic Roman Catholic parishes, Presbyterians, Lutherans of every stripe, Jewish synagogues, and almost every major denomination, Catholic, Protestant, and Jew, had sanctuaries that had been declared. Well, how do we start to make sense of this? How do we start to reflect about what these folks are doing? I'm going to talk a little more than I usually do at these sessions tonight, knowing that we have a forum and a chance to air our various views. Usually I talk 20 minutes, maybe 25, and then open it for discussion. I'm a preacher by trade. I'm a pastor in Northwest Detroit. I usually can't talk more than 25 minutes without everybody responding. I mean, you all ought to stand up now and say the creed or sing a hymn. I mean, I get tired of my own voice. But I'm going to make an exception tonight, knowing we have a forum, and plow ahead with some heady stuff that I hope we have a chance to talk together about. There's a great variety and diversity within the sanctuary movement, as well as within the churches, in trying to understand it. And I'm going to situate myself rather firmly in one wing of the movement. And if you're in another place in the movement, or if you're critical of the whole thing, I'd love to talk with you. I really do welcome your questions and want to go at it. What I'd like to suggest is that the ancient and medieval and even biblical concept of sanctuary is not exactly the most helpful way to understand what's really going on. The problem with the notion of sanctuary is that sanctuary means you're harboring criminals from the state. It was the accused murderer who fled to the horns of the altar. It was the person accused of blasphemy, treason, or murder who fled into the set-aside sanctuaries of medieval England. It was people who were branded criminals who were given temporary haven until the system could, in most cases, apprehend them and take care of them one way or another. There's another way of understanding these set of actions, which I want to call civil initiative. Civil initiative. And I want to set it up as a contrast to any notions of civil disobedience. I don't think the sanctuary workers are breaking the law. Let me toss down the gauntlet. I don't think they're breaking the law. I think it's the U.S. government, the INS, and the U.S. Attorney General, which are breaking the law in this case. So far, the judges haven't agreed with that. Stacey Lynn Merkt has been convicted of transporting Salvadorans. Jack Elder has been convicted of transporting and harboring Salvadoran refugees. 8 sanctuary workers in Tucson have been convicted of smuggling, transporting, harboring, and conspiracy to all of the above, with potential prison sentences of up to 25 years for their actions, but they in fact received probation. So none of the juries or the judges have agreed with my interpretation yet. I am rather more hopeful of the appeals process, which is not exhausted in any of the cases, nor even begun in the most important case in Tucson. Well, now I'm going to have to defend my thesis. My thesis, sanctuary is not breaking the law. It's a justified case of civil initiative. I'd like to start, instead of with Old Testament cities of refuge or medieval English sanctuaries, I'd rather start a little closer to home. I'd want to start with World War II and what happened in World War II. When I was in Tucson, I sat down for an interview with Rabbi Joseph Weizenbaum, who is rabbi of Temple Emmanuel, large 1,000-family Jewish congregation in Tucson, which declared sanctuary in 1984. And he clarified what's happening in sanctuary better than anyone I've talked with. This is an article I wrote that's not published in parentheses yet. I hope it will be eventually, but this is my current stuff on sanctuary, so when I'm looking at my notes, that's what I've got here. He understands the sanctuary as a response to the Holocaust. Sanctuary as a response to the Holocaust. From the ridiculous to the sublime here, I guess. Or vice versa. I've been very hesitant to appeal to the Holocaust for any kind of precedent, to any kind of position that I hold. And I've never done it before. The only reason I can do it now is because Rabbi Weizenbaum set out the case so persuasively. And so I'm going to use his words, not even my own. He said first that he has a family connection to the Holocaust as it happened in World War II. He said, "My aunt and uncle knocked on doors in Germany trying to find someone who would take them in. No one took them in. They died in the camps." Now, he goes on, who are the Jews and who are the bystanders when it comes to Central American refugees? Are we going to stand around and let them be killed? Or are we going to learn from experience and be part of the solution? He then draws the key connection for our interpretation here. He said, the same human evil that perpetrated the Holocaust is at work in Central America. The Holocaust was unique in that it was genocide, yes, but from the victim's perspective, the evil looks the same. The Jews now, he says, are the Central Americans. And then he says, and we who know what it's like to be victims, are we now going to be the bystanders? He calls on his fellow Jews to know who you are and to follow the Torah admonitions to care for strangers. I then asked him, do you think sanctuary is breaking the law? And he said to me, pretend you're a Jew. Here's what I would say to you. Imagine you live in Germany in 1942, and a Christian family in your neighborhood is discussing whether they ought to let a Jewish family in from down the street. Then you, a Jew, walk in. Will you say that they should not take you or your neighbors in because that would mean breaking the law and one couldn't now break such a law? Just as it was then right for Christians to take in Jews, so today it is right for Jews to take in Christians. By that he meant that the undocumented Salvadorans are chiefly Roman Catholic, and so he was appealing to his Jewish congregation. In that same spirit, there's a key quote from President Roosevelt about the same time in World War II. President Roosevelt made in this radio appeal, "I ask every German and every man everywhere, or woman we should say, under Nazi domination, to show the world by his action that he does not share these insane criminal desires. Let him hide these pursued victims. Help them to get over the border and do what he can to save them from the Nazi hangman. We call upon the free peoples of Europe and Asia temporarily to open their frontiers to all victims of oppression. We shall find havens of refuge for them, and we shall find the means for their maintenance and support until a tyrant is driven from their homelands and they may return." Change the name of the countries, and you have, I suggest, a word-for-word appeal for precisely what the sanctuary movement is providing. Is it really that bad in Central America? Has to be the question that comes to your mind. I mean, the Holocaust is a unique experience. The unique appeal by our president for people to break the law of their homeland in the name of a higher law, of international law, of protecting vulnerable refugees. Let me read you what Amnesty International says. This is a 1985 report of theirs. "Amnesty International has been concerned for a number of years about continuing reports that the security forces in El Salvador have been regularly involved in a systematic and widespread program of torture, disappearance, and extrajudicial execution of men, women, and children. Such persons have been shot outright, singly or en masse, or have been seized by groups of armed men, sometimes in uniform, and on other occasions in plain clothes, and taken to secret detention centers. The whereabouts of thousands of such people has never been clarified. Many others have been found dead." I say that in general. I'm not going to tell the specific kind of horror stories and incidents that could be recounted, and you can read about. I can refer you to the areas if you do want to read about it. For the same reason that our courts don't allow gruesome detail and evidence, because it clouds our judgment. There's things so stomach-turning, and especially here after supper, 8 at the second setting, that it's not... You just can't think rationally anymore when you start to hear these stories. So I'll suffice it to read this kind of general report about the kinds of torture and disappearance and murder that's driven one-fifth of the whole population to flee their homes. And so many people have been murdered. Now, why is this a direct connection to sanctuary? Because what grew out of this response to the Holocaust was a chain of events in international law that leads precisely up to civil initiative. Let me outline the chain first, and then I'll go back and fill in the details. First of all, following the war were the Nuremberg trials, convicting the individual Nazi officials who had been responsible for the war crimes. Second was the Geneva Conventions, which were adopted in 1949, which set in international law inviolable rights of war victims and refugees. Third was the United Nations, which adopted a protocol on the status of refugees in 1967. And finally, in 1980, the U.S., with its Refugee Act of 1980, incorporated all of this into our law. Our federal code now includes all of what I'm about to describe. So this is not a history lesson. This is a lesson in what sits in the eighth volume of the United States Code, starting with Section 1154. So this is what we have. Two things to be said about the Nuremberg trials. First was that they established for the first time in international law, the principle of individual accountability. Previously, international law only applied between nations. It was laws that governed the relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, or between Nicaragua and its neighbors. But the Nuremberg trials established the principle of individual responsibility. As U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, who was the chief counsel for the U.S. at the trials, said in his opening statement, "The principle of personal liability is a necessary as well as a logical one if international law is to render real help in the maintenance of peace. An international law which operates only on states can be enforced only by war, because the most practicable method of coercing a state is warfare. If international law is to mean anything, it has to apply to individuals. Otherwise, the only way its decisions can be enforced is by warfare between states." So that's an important first principle that's established. The second principle is the priority of international law over domestic law in certain kinds of cases. Justice Jackson said, "How a government treats its own citizens generally is thought to be of no concern to other governments or of intervention or of international society. Certainly few oppressions or cruelty would warrant the intervention of foreign powers. But the German mistreatment of Germans is now known to pass in magnitude and savagery any limits of what is tolerable by modern civilization. Other nations, by silence, would take a consenting part in such crimes." He said that the people of Germany were responsible to international law, which prevented the commission of such war crimes and crimes against humanity, even though the German laws were all being obeyed. And they were prosecuted for following the German laws, even though they were disobeying international law. That got the ball rolling. The second thing was the Geneva Conventions. After World War II, those of you who are old enough to have been around at the time may remember the huge number of refugees which were just cast upon Europe. Millions of refugees, many of whom were not being particularly well cared for. One of my mentors at St. Olaf College, Howard Hong, is well known for his work bringing musical instruments into the refugee camps in Europe after World War II to bring a sense of humanity and civilization back to a place of such barbarity and chaos. Well, it wasn't only individual ministries of persons. There was also the Geneva Conventions, which set in law and became a U.S. treaty obligation, a commitment to care for refugees. And two principles are particularly important here. One, refugees may not be forcibly repatriated until after the cessation of hostilities. You can't send a refugee back while their home country is still embroiled in the conflict that sent them out in the first place. That's what that says. And secondly, refugees may not be sent to any state that has not demonstrated a willingness or ability to comply with humanitarian norms. El Salvador has been consistently criticized by the U.S. Department of State, as well as Amnesty International, America's Watch, United Nations, and others, as failing to live up to traditional humanitarian norms. Well, the State Department says they're improving, but it certainly doesn't say that they live up to humanitarian norms. So on both counts, Salvadoran refugees are protected under the Geneva Conventions. The UN, United Nations, adopted the Protocol on the Status of Refugees in 1967. That's another treaty that was entered into by the United Nations. And then the provisions of that treaty were incorporated into U.S. law in 1980. And two key parts I want to draw out of that law. One is that the definition of a refugee is now in law a humanitarian definition and not a political definition. Previously, we accepted refugees from where? From, you know, ping pong players from China. Russian ballerinas, Polish dissidents from communist countries. That's who we accepted. And why? Makes us look good. We take in people from our enemies. That means they're doing something wrong that drives people into exile. But a new consensus was developing after the horrible refugee situation following World War II, that refugees ought to be protected wherever they come from, simply because they're human beings. And that definition, that humanitarian human rights definition, was incorporated into U.S. law. And secondly, in the course of the discussion, it was explicit in Congress that they intended U.S. law to be in accord with its international obligations. They wanted U.S. refugee practice to fit with what the rest of the world was doing with refugees. And so this law was adopted. Now, I want to claim that sanctuary workers are simply following these laws, and that it's the U.S. government which is violating these laws by prosecuting the sanctuary workers. The argument depends on the Geneva Convention definitions of who has what rights to be protected as refugees, and it depends on the U.S. code enactment of these provisions and definition of refugees, such that refugees are not simply politically defined by the U.S. Attorney General, but they have rights prior to any determination by what the United States government says. So when these churches, and it's not only churches anymore, there's more than 20 cities around the country which have declared their city to be a sanctuary, as large as St. Paul, Minnesota, and Rochester, New York, as small as Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Berkeley, California. And the entire state of New Mexico has declared itself a sanctuary by order of Governor Tony Anaya. So it's no longer just churches and synagogues. It's cities and now one state, which are all acting in resistance to immigration, the INS, and the federal government policies. And when the sanctuary workers come to trial, what's happened so far is there's been one question asked. What did they do? Did they harbor or transport such and such persons on such and such date? Are such and such persons legal residents of the United States? Well, no, not formally, not by the INS decision. Therefore, they're guilty. It's simply the behavior. You could have recorded their actions with a Kodak camera and played it in the courtroom, and that would have determined whether they were guilty or innocent. What has not been allowed is any of the interpretation of the laws. It's simply a question of applying one law, namely a statute on smuggling and harboring, to one set of actions. This question of what happens with international law, the meaning of the U.S. Refugee Act, it's so new in judicial terms. 1980 is very recent. The Supreme Court hasn't decided anything on it. Very few circuit courts have decided anything on it, courts of appeal. So it's up in the air. I'm writing and working like crazy to help public opinion and the courts to see that what sanctuary is doing is not breaking bad laws. The sanctuary movement is upholding good laws. And the reason it's not civil disobedience is that they're not trying to change any laws. They're simply trying to see that the laws on the books are enforced and complied with. So I claim sanctuary is not breaking the law. Sanctuary is upholding it. And it's the U.S. Attorney General who's in fact breaking it. Well, I talk twice as long as I usually do in these sessions. I imagine there's a few of you who are sitting and stewing. We're going to have plenty of chance for discussion between now and the forum. At the forum, I want to focus on the question of Christians in the legal order and where our theology comes into all of this. I haven't talked much about theology, have I? But that's coming up. What do you think? Yeah.
The thing you haven't referred to, which I always find troubling when we look at this issue, is it's always sort of seen in terms of a particular part of the world. El Salvador or Central America. So what about the fact that there are over 200,000 Cambodians sitting right now on the border of Thailand that the United Nations Commission on Refugees refuses to process any of them, and they probably would be forced back into Cambodia to face certain death? Or what about the people in South Africa or Ethiopia who have very much wanted to flee a repressive situation and may well have died out? It seems that what you're saying is, if we buy the basic assumptions, we must open the door to people from all over the world, where there are indeed people that are in danger for their life because of the repressive governments they live in.
Wherever there are genuine refugees, the international community is obligated to care for them. Now, what's particular about the Salvadorans is that they're getting here on foot, or in a few cases by boat, and that's where the Haitians come in too. And that's where they're really part of the same story. And we've learned an awful lot about Haiti in the last year. That's why it's so urgent. But what you'll notice about my interpretation is that I entirely agree with you. Because the focus of the sanctuary activities, as far as I'm concerned, is upholding the crucial developments in international law protecting refugees over the last two generations. What some in sanctuary are trying to do is to use sanctuary as a means to confront U.S. foreign policy. Their focus is what the U.S. is doing in El Salvador. Well, that naturally comes out of the stories, and I've said some things about that. But the refugees aren't simply in this country and in sanctuary in order to talk about U.S. foreign policy in El Salvador. They're here and should be here because they deserve protection. So I want to broaden that scope precisely to include that kind. There are anywhere between 10 and 16 million refugees worldwide, depending on just what year you're in and how you define it. 8 million just in Africa, let alone Southeast Asia, let alone, you know, what's going to be an increasing problem across our southern border. So we could probably take in 16 million people, but that would shake up a lot of folks in the process. That's where I'm coming from on it. Yeah, more. Go ahead.
In front. Couldn't this run into some problem with who determines who's a refugee and who's not a refugee?
Sure does.
All the illegal aliens coming from Mexico, they could say they're refugees.
Absolutely. That's.
And then, you know, you don't want to say, well, you can stay and you have to go back and.
What impressed me, however, about the possibilities for this is when I was down, the ALC Office of Church and Society sent me down to do some reports on what's going on there in May for 4 days. That's when I referred to sitting and talking with these folks. That's when I was down there at the end of May. I happened to be privileged to sit in on the group in Tucson, which you might call sort of the inner circle of the Underground Railroad, the people who actually do the work. Bring them across the border, send them out on the transportation networks to various places around the country. Only 1 in 20 people that they help actually goes into sanctuary. The other 19 are all kept underground. Sanctuary is just a small tip of the iceberg, is what everybody focuses on, but it's not most of what they do. But what I was impressed with is that they only help a handful of the people that come to them for help. And I sat in while they were assessing cases, just as if they had been what an INS, what the U.S. government ought to be doing in its hearings. They were assessing the story. They had someone who'd go down and meet with a person in a church in Mexico, spend a couple days with them, get to know them, hear the whole story. They've got all the contacts throughout the churches in Mexico and in El Salvador. They can double-check all the facts of the story. They can know what's going on with these people. They know the region. They know the dialects. They know the army officers who are doing what where, and they can piece it together, and they approve and they disapprove. They don't help, I can't remember the figure, but they don't help even a majority of the people who come to them. They're kind of hearing officers what they feel the government ought to be doing. So they have found in practice an ability to not only weigh the difference between Mexicans and Salvadorans, but among Salvadorans as to those who are genuinely threatened and those who, well, they just kind of came up because their brother did. I was impressed with that ability. And if this people, group of people who are all amateurs at it, have just learned this over the course of experience, I have some confidence that those kinds of decisions can be made. Every right is going to be abused. There's going to be mistakes made, but does that mean you terminate a right? Just because freedom of speech is abused, does that mean we no longer have the right of freedom of speech? Well, it's an important enough right that we don't. We'll accept the abuse, but the right of refuge, I would make similar claims for. Yeah.
Could you examine for us briefly what you think are the reasons why the Reagan administration would be interested in sending the Salvadorian back for a certain death?
Well, not certain death.
Possibility of death.
Possible death. The statistics are really slippery on that one, on both sides. Neither side has done very well. But to,
it exists.
Okay, it does exist, and anybody would say it does exist, in to some degree. There's the explicit and the implicit reason that I would put forward. The explicit reason is that these are economic migrants; they're not political refugees. They're leaving a generally turbulent and poor area, but that does not specifically qualify them for asylum under our narrow definition of what asylum is. And they can quote certain particularly narrow definitions for which some apply, some qualify and some don't. They're not talking about the broader categories of international law that I have. And so under those definitions, they say, well, we can't take all 13,000 a year who apply for asylum. They take about 3%. 3% from Honduras, 3% from El Salvador, about 0.5% from Guatemala, about 9% from Nicaragua, compared to 30-some percent from Poland, 60-some percent from Iran, and so on. So the explicit reason is that they don't fit the qualifications, and we have our hearing officers who accept the testimony, and we take it on a case-by-case basis, and if you don't like this case, well, it can be appealed. But in the implicit reason, and in fact, the State Department has a form letter that they send out to the INS when they're asked for their judgment on whether someone should receive asylum or not regarding the conditions in El Salvador. The implicit reason is that we cannot provide, by U.S. Congress law, we cannot provide military aid to any country which is a human rights abuser. Why does the State Department have to prove that human rights situation is improving in El Salvador? There's a particular clause which says we cannot provide military aid if they violate these human rights codes. So what would happen if they granted extended voluntary departure? What would happen if they said, well, all 500,000 Salvadorans, you can stay here until it's safe to go home because things are so horrible back in your home country that you deserve to have our protection? Well, what that would say to our friendly government in El Salvador, at least between our administration and their administration, is you're doing so poorly that we're going to accept people fleeing from your terror. And so there's a political foreign policy message at stake here. And it's crucial for the Reagan administration to see El Salvador as improving, as the model for democracy, as opposed to Nicaragua, in Central America. And so Salvadoran refugees have to be sent back because it's a wonderful place to go. Well, not quite wonderful, but it's sure a lot better than Nicaragua and so on. And so they're sending them back for that foreign policy objective. And if they kept them, it would undercut the whole Central American policy. So that's the implicit stuff that's going on, as far as I can tell. Yeah.
Where does the cost factor come into all of this? Granted, you bring refugees over here, and we're faced with this with the Cubans and so forth, we pin them up and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And is the Reagan administration then bringing the cost back to those people who are going to be on welfare all the time, the cost for them? The
well,
churches
that's,
aren't going to support them indefinitely.
Well, that's an important question, and there's a number of assumptions behind what you're saying. One, I disagree that they're mostly going to go on welfare. Some studies have shown that illegal aliens or undocumented workers create more jobs than they take in our economy. And I think I happen to be a capitalist of a particular sort, and I happen to think our economy is vibrant enough to be able to absorb and to grow vastly beyond some of the stagnant kinds of expectations we've had of it in the last decade or so. I think we've got wonderful capacities in this country to take in hardworking people, and people who come to this country are chiefly those with a spunk to try to improve their lives. So I'm not sure about that assumption. The other question, though, is a real one, and it's a real one for the churches. You know, there are transition needs, and who's going to pay? Well, churches have paid for many refugees in the past, although that's not quite the case. The government really pays the churches to do the resettling, and that's decreasing steadily. So that, you know, crucial question, and it cuts to the heart of how important we feel about human rights. Well, we're going to have to get over to Vespers here. I have the feeling like we're just sitting on the top of a volcano or the tip of an iceberg. And I'm glad. I want you to disagree with me or to say what you think or to agree with me and work it through. We've got an hour coming up in a few minutes here, and come back if you want. Bring your friends, whatever, and let's work it through.